was recorded on January 8, 1988 at Van Hise Hall at the University of Wisconsin. It concerns campus unrest at the university in the late 60s and the events leading up to President Harrington's resignation in the spring of 1970. The interview was recorded by Tom Bates for a book on the New Year's Gang for Harper and Row. The entire discussion was on the record and it may be quoted for attribution. President Harrington begins with a discussion of how he became president in 1962, his appointment by the Board of Regents after a struggle between the scientific, agricultural, and humanities factions on campus. Harrington was the humanities candidate.
The scientists then pretty much ran the university. Elvium's predecessor, E.B. Fred, and Elvium were both natural scientists, biological scientists, as were the other persons of power. And Elvium was in the graduate school. There was, however, a great revolt on the part of the social sciences humanities people who demanded a little more consideration and objected to the fact that the president and the vice president and the dean of the graduate school were all biological scientists, and in particular objected to the fact that the top administration didn't seem to help the social sciences and humanities much, and in particular kept all the Wisconsin alumni research money for natural science. Originally, a little bit of it had gone to social sciences and humanities, but then it was all given to the natural scientists. We began a program of protest. I was then in the history department, and with social scientists, particularly political science, sociology, anthropology.
Was Indian history your particular specialty?
No, American history. I'm American Foreign Relations. Bill Williams major professor.
Okay, that's right.
I was a historian who was close to the social scientists. In fact, my American Foreign Relations was sometimes listed in political science, so I was among the historians, not one who leaned towards humanities, but leaned towards the social sciences. And we were protesting, and we finally got a little piece of the war money. But this was a big thing. Were we going to be put down, and the scientists going to run things, or were we going to be involved? So when E.B. Fred retired as president, I became the social science candidate. I was by that time special assistant to President Fred because under pressure he brought me in.
I see.
When I came back from Europe in 1956, and I was from 56 to 58, I was special assistant to President Fred, working for the social sciences inside the administration. And when the regents had to pick a president, they had to pick between me, the representative of the social sciences, humanities, and Elvium as a representative of the natural sciences, and the preferred, of course, by the outgoing president and whatnot. Elvium got it. Well, he's a very distinguished person. Should have had the Nobel Prize. A great scientist. Much more important as a scientist than I was as a historian. But I was the social science representative, and I didn't get it, but Elvium asked me to be his vice president so that he would be able to get along with the social sciences. I was that, and for 4 years I was his vice president and helped him as much as I could, but also worked for the social sciences and humanities, and we did get some money, particularly from the foundations at that time. That was what I did mostly, I suppose.
Was that 58 to 62?
58 to 62, when Elvium was president. I was vice president. Then Elvium died. I was about to leave. I had been appointed president of the University of Hawaii. And was in Japan, actually. I had not taken the Hawaiian job yet. I was going to take it in the fall. But I was out there on a Fulbright lectureship in Japan when Elvium died. I then was brought back as president because since I'd been the runner-up, since I was going to Hawaii and there was a great demand to keep me here, I was made president. But the important point is by that time the Board of Regents had changed. Instead of being a kind of a right-wing Republican Board of Regents, it had become a mixed Board of Regents with a strong Democratic liberal influence because Gaylord Nelson had become governor.
and the regents had shifted over, so that even though Elvin was president, I was much closer to the regents than Elvin was. Indeed, while he was president, I'd saved him from a very difficult position in the with the medical school by reason of having influence with the regents. So it was logical enough that when Elvin died, I was brought in as president immediately,
mm-hmm.
with the support of the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
The people who had been in favor of me or Elvin asked that I be named. In fact, I was extraordinarily popular president at the beginning. I had the support of the faculty, I had the support of the regents, I had the support from downtown because Nelson was still governor,
mm-hmm.
Wanted me to be president, and I had the support of the other parts of the university, like the Milwaukee campus, because I had been the main person inside the administration who worked for the Milwaukee campus. Thus, I came in very popular and had my own way.
Were you president of the entire system, right?
Yes, except it was not a system then. I was president of the university, which meant Madison,
uh-huh.
and Milwaukee, and Extension, and the two-year campuses. It was still the University of Wisconsin, though. It was not a system. It was a system, but it was the University of Wisconsin. And all the teachers' colleges, which are now parts of the university, had become state colleges, but they were in a separate system.
The state colleges were separate?
Separate system.
So you didn't have anything to do with Whitewater and Oshkosh?
Whitewater, Oshkosh.
Stevens Point.
Stevens Point, River Falls, so on. No, no, I was the president of Madison campus, Milwaukee, the two-year campuses, Extension,
mm-hmm.
agriculture extension and general extension.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was really the person that ran the Madison campus, because there was no chief Madison officer in those days. In fact, the general feeling was that the Madison campus was the campus and the whole university,
mm-hmm.
and that the rest was just on the fringe.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this in that I was president of the university, but ran the Madison campus. And there was a provost in Milwaukee who
mm-hmm.
was under me, and
uh-huh.
there were persons in the other parts of the mm-hmm. university, but they all were under me. So that at the beginning of my presidency, I ran everything. This is of some consequence because the general feeling was that I was still in charge in Madison when the troubles came along beginning in 1967.
Right.
Yet at that time, we were already making a transition because the university was growing so rapidly. We were establishing two new degree-granting campuses in Racine and Racine Kenosha and in Green Bay,
mm-hmm.
Parkside and Green Bay.
Mm-hmm.
We were establishing those. They were built upon our two-year campuses, but we made them degree-granting campuses.
Uh-huh.
So that we were going to have four campuses, and of course Extension was getting bigger, so that it was at that point that we moved towards having a chief Madison official. That was, well, maybe 1964, 65. We appointed a provost here, later made him chancellor. That was Bob Fleming, brought up from in Illinois, and who left us in 67 to go to Michigan as president,
uh-huh.
where he still is president, or is president again now. Bob Fleming,
mm-hmm.
Robin, R-O-B-B-N, Fleming.
Right.
But it was at that point that we turned the David A. administration of Madison campus and the other campuses over to the chief officer there, and when we appointed a provost here. Actually, we prepared for this by having my vice president, Bob Clodius, who's now the head of the state universities.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Clodius was acting provost,
oh.
say in 63, 64, something like that. Then we brought Fleming in. Fleming was, in any case, a Madison person. He'd been trained here in the law school and had been a professor. So that we did this to bring in an outsider into the Madison campus, as mm-hmm. we've done now with Donna Shalala, would have been difficult at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
and not desirable, but it should have.
Now, what was to be the function of the chancellor vis-a-vis the president?
The chancellor, as in any system, California system being perhaps the best known, the president has overall charge.
Uh-huh.
And handles the legislature and handles the budget and hands it out to the various campuses.
Mm-hmm.
But the internal matter of handling the campus is in the hands of the chancellor.
Okay.
This is of substantial importance with reference to the student troubles, but
yes.
Has rather special importance, well, special relevance here, because I was still turning the thing over when this came, when the student trouble began.
Mm-hmm.
Let me illustrate.
Mm-hmm.
Since athletics is a big thing in any of our Big Ten universities, I stayed in politics, but I also stayed in athletics. I had no alternative, really, because the regents were interested in athletics.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was involved in the appointing of the athletic director as late as 67, when already student troubles were beginning. That was when Hirsch was brought in.
Uh-huh.
Hirsch.
Uh-huh.
Let me make the point now. When I became president, we had a good year and we went to the Rose Bowl. I became president in 62, went to the Rose Bowl in 63.
Mm-hmm.
The last time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very dramatic Rose Bowl, and we lost but almost won.
Uh-huh.
Actually, of course, if we had present rules, we wouldn't have gone, because the rules then were that the winner of the Big Ten couldn't go 2 years in a row, maybe 3 years in a row. So we were runner-up to Ohio State, I think, and we're actually tied with Purdue for second place, third place, and yet we'd beaten Purdue, so we were invited, and we went. And lots of people thought I would be against our going, because I'd been an anti-athletic type as a professor.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we should go, and,
mm-hmm.
and certainly the regents wanted to go, but I still retain my anti-athletic position to some extent, because when we had a regent discussion of it, I stated publicly that postseason athletics was not very important. Got a lot of trouble when I got out to California, and
mm-hmm.
and in any case, I make the point because I still, at the end of the season, went to the football banquet. Not because I was interested in athletics, but because that was expected of me.
Right.
And the president of the university was still involved in the athletic team. I mention this because I got the blame pretty much for the student troubles, even though by that time the question had been turned over to the Madison campus chancellor, so that when we had a bad football season, I had to go to the football banquet too, and was involved in the appointment of Hirsch, although that really should have been the chancellor's job.
Uh-huh.
And when the question was, should we fire the coach before Mr. Bill Broom? Should we fire him? That was a question which I was brought into the athletic board, even though we already had a chancellor. Oh, we had a provost who was becoming chancellor, and the Capital Times hasn't forgiven me for this, saying that I was the guy that fired Milt Broom. See, although I should
fired
be.
Who?
Milt Broom was the football coach.
Milt Broom?
B-R-U-H-N.
Uh-huh.
He was the football coach who went to the Rose Bowl in 63. But he had bad seasons after that because he had given up on recruiting. It was too dull for him.
Oh.
And the Cap Times says, oh, I'm a great president, but the one thing they have against me was that I found Bill fired my phone. Actually, I didn't. I kept him for a year longer than the athletic board wanted to.
I see.
But I never bothered. It doesn't matter very great importance to me, except it has some relationship to this. Because when the first student troubles came, we had a president and a provost, and I think we had moved from provost to chancellor. After Fleming got here, we made him chancellor, and we made the Milwaukee provost Clutchy chancellor too, so that, and we made him mm-hmm. chancellor for extension.
Mm-hmm.
Chancellor in Green Bay and and in Parkside, so we're talking about chancellors here now.
Yeah.
Though the provost title was still in at the beginning. Well, when the first troubles came, and the first student protest, Fleming was still here.
Talking about Dow.
No, this is actually before the big Dow trouble.
Oh.
The big Dow trouble, when there was a riot and all that kind of thing, came right after Fleming left, when Bill Sewell was.
Oh, that's right.
Have you talked to Sewell?
No.
You should. He was involved in these student troubles, although he, of course, had left chancellorship before it came along. In any case, the first student troubles came with demonstrations and so on, and demonstrations outside the president's office and the provost and the chancellor's office and whatnot, and demands, non-negotiable demands already, on the part of leaders. There were relatively few real radicals here, but one of them was here, Bob Cohen, Robert
mm-hmm.
Cohen.
Yeah.
Cohen, who later left here and went to Buffalo. I guess the philosophy department here kicked him out or whatever.
Uh-huh.
He was a student. He was a graduate student.
I think he was expelled.
Expelled by the...
In 68 sometime.
Not for disciplinary reasons.
Yeah, I think in connection
maybe
with the
so.
Dow riots, perhaps?
Maybe so. In any case, I don't want to say anything because I don't remember it, but I do remember Cohen being involved in these first troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And when there were protests outside the president's office, obviously not an occupation of the president's office, but protests outside it and so on.
Yeah.
I was called in to talk. I was called in, but I guess I was home, called into my office to talk.
Mm-hmm.
I called Fleming and said, how about your coming in? And he said, oh no, he'd been advised by Hansen not to come, stay home. That he shouldn't talk. Well, I said, I'm the president, but you're the chancellor. And I think you ought to be there. Already you'd had the Berkeley problems. And already I knew that Kerr took charge of everything, although he was president, and there was a chance.
Yes.
And in Strong.
That's right.
In fact, Kerr ran everything on the Berkeley campus. When I was out there visiting before the student troubles,
yeah.
There were signs up saying, keep off the grass by order of the president.
Really?
Even though it should have said by order of
the chancellor.
He absolutely ran everything. Same way that Bill Friday did in North Carolina. He never stopped running Chapel Hill,
uh-huh.
even though he had a system too with other campuses and one important other campus.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the problems that Kerr had, and it seemed to me clear that he stuck his neck out too much, and that the chancellor ought to be running it, at least at first.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the general view in the state was that I was completely in charge, but I felt this was the right to turn over.
Mm-hmm.
My timing of recollection may not be all that good, but things were beginning to happen by this time. The Berkeley thing had happened. It seemed like the Columbia thing had begun to happen.
Well, Columbia, 68, I think.
68.
After Dow.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's later. But the Berkeley thing had begun to happen.
Oh, yeah.
And Kerr had decided he was in charge.
Yeah.
And he got all the flack because he reported to us in the Association of American Universities, you know, Science Freedom under Clark Kerr, F-U-C-K.
Which tested him on obscenity as well as on protests.
What was the acronym again?
Freedom under Clark Kerr.
I see.
Big signs. When there was some protest on the part of obscenities as well as
I see.
As well as other things. and of course he had it tough. Well,
yeah.
In any case, it seemed to me that Fleming should be in on it. So I called him in, and together we met with
the co-op who seemed to be most interested, and a few others. We kept her out of the room. She couldn't do later, I guess. Kept her out of the president's office. I was still in Bascom. We were both in Bascom. I was in the office that's now the chancellor's office for you. And the chancellor was down the other end. I was on my way to getting out because we were building this building. And since we developed this chancellor system, I suggested to the building commission we had some floors here so we'd have a central administration here and we'd be out of the way of the Madison campus, although we couldn't really be out of town since this was the capital.
Yeah.
In any case, we're still in Bascom, and this is how it began. At that point, I said to Cohen and to Fleming, this is the chapter's business. They should be able to chant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And after that first discussion, they did.
I see.
And at one, then from then on, Fleming did it. Of course, he talked to me about it, but he did it, and he handled it pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Cohen was saying, we're going to keep you prisoner, because he was had a meeting at the end of a hall, which people learn not to do later on in the Troubles.
Yeah.
Fleming said, well, I'm a lawyer. You do that, and the minute you try to keep me prisoner, I'll have the law on you. Which in those days worked. Later on, it didn't. Yeah. And indeed, in those days, the radicals were still praising us to some extent. For example, in that first meeting, Cohen praised me because I had resigned from the Madison Club because we tried to get a Jew in, and they had him blackballed.
Really?
So I resigned.
Uh-huh.
It seems awfully old. Doesn't it? It seems old stuff.
Yeah.
Long way back. Cohen said, "Well, fine. Why don't you work with us?"
You know? Do you remember what it was that Cohen wanted you to do at that time?
Guess I'd have to refresh my mind on this. Maybe it was keeping Dow off the campus, although Dow didn't come until after Cohen had left.
Yes. Well, there had been a previous conflict over Dow in, I think, February of '67 in the winter, and it didn't get violent. There had been
that was probably it.
Yeah.
And that these things seem to run on through. In any case, I thought Fleming handled this quite well, and there were some people arrested in connection with that.
Yeah, I think there was some kind of sit-in or something.
Yeah, and the sit-in was after this first encounter, which I mentioned, Minja, because I turned it over to Fleming. And there were some arrests made. Fleming, who was, after Fleming's not only a lawyer, but a labor negotiator, and able to handle things pretty well.
I see.
Better than I, anyway. Though, of course, it became difficult and impossible later. But he showed this ability. He said it's a lot easier at Michigan than here. He told me that later.
Yeah.
But when the Troubles came and people were put in jail then, he bailed them out. He bailed them out, which was his effort to show that he was on both sides. Just
right.
He was trying to make
sense. Right, I remember.
He tried to handle
that.
It.
Yeah.
He bailed them out because he had just done some labor negotiation and received a check for $4,000 or something like that. And
yeah.
So he had a lot of money in his bank account, which even university administrators didn't have in those days.
Yeah.
And he put the money up, a couple thousand dollars, for the bailing out.
Yeah.
And when the money was returned, it was given to the lawyers of the protesters, and they gave it, and they never gave it back to Fleming. He never got it back.
You're kidding.
Check of Fleming, but that he's the one that told me that. Never got it back.
That is disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. Though I don't suppose that's been publicized much.
I never heard that.
Anyway, take a phone call to Fleming. You should talk to Fleming.
I should, yeah. I will.
Talk to Fleming, of course, had lots of troubles in Michigan, but handled them well, I thought. As he said, the trouble part is great. Yeah. Well, it was right at that point. Fleming got some reputation out of this. Because in those days, you still could get some reputation.
Yeah.
Out of handling the troubles.
Yes.
It wasn't
right.
Much longer.
He was considered pretty good at it.
And he was.
Now, you're...
And then he had simultaneous offers from Minnesota and Michigan.
Uh-huh.
He was, in any case, a lawyer in a high administrative position, the head of the Prestige campus, and naturally his lawyer friends in all places, Minnesota, Michigan, and so on, or whatever, would be interested in him. At that time, it was uncommon for lawyers to head institutions, and he had to have a PhD with a doctorate.
Right.
So that, although I suppose he became one when they turned law degrees into doctor's degrees and did it if you paid $25. Yes, and he then went to he chose Michigan against Minnesota, better place.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Minnesota is a place you could build, and Michigan is already built.
Michigan was also somewhat of a hot spot. It was a real hot spot. Ann Arbor, right, was a real hot spot in those times.
Yes, it was. It was. In fact, his predecessor, in reporting to the presidents, said he was scared to death. Well, he obviously was. He talked to us. He was scared. This is quite different. Kerr was not scared and seemed rather amused.
Oh, really?
Well, he told these things like the F.U.C.K. story.
Yeah.
He told them with great, and about Joan Baez being, he obviously couldn't measure up to her, not having charisma or anything.
Right.
He is a rather dull-looking fellow.
Yeah.
So, I remember, what's the name of his predecessor? In any case, he was, the president's house was right on campus.
And
president was scared to death. So obviously Fleming was a much better person at that. But of course, great loss to us because when he left, we then made Sewell chairman. Sewell chancellor.
Yes, right.
Sewell's a very capable person. In fact, more of a sociology research man, a very capable person. The person responsible for making the sociology department here the number one department in the country, which it is now, can be rated number one.
Uh-huh.
History isn't anymore. And this is a major person and a liberal.
Yeah.
Quite sympathetic with the students.
Yeah.
But lacking the skills of Fleming, which I also lacked.
Yeah.
And lacking the judgment, for example, in the Dow case, to have Dow interview people off campus.
Uh-huh.
If we should have known.
Right.
So we got ourselves into trouble. When this trouble came, the Dow trouble, into 67?
Yeah, October 67. October 18th was the big riot.
That would be it, because that would mean that it was right after Sewell took over, because Fleming was in charge in the early part of 67 when the troubles began.
Mm-hmm.
So that Sewell was in charge, and in fact I made a great point that he was in charge, and indeed when the troubles began to stem, I went over to Milwaukee, which I had to do quite a bit anyway, but it seemed to me this was giving him, it wasn't as though I was telling him what to do.
Uh-huh.
Not that I'd have done any better, but when I was in Milwaukee, the real troubles began. And I was coming back, and I was in touch, because I heard it when I was in Milwaukee. The trouble.
When you went down to Milwaukee, you mean you went down just to visit, to do some business there.
Business there. University of Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I had a meeting which probably was previously scheduled with a group of Milwaukee faculty.
So you weren't on campus the day of the
I was not on campus when it began, but. When it began, I was called in Milwaukee, came and phoned again to one of my assistants from when I reached the other side of town, and then came in, and the troubles were, the big matter of the trouble was over.
That's true. When you got back.
When I got back, but the decisions with reference to it were still there. So immediately, of course, I went to Sewell's office, and it was up to him to handle it. But I was certainly anxious to support him in every way. Sewell was shocked by the damage that was done by the police. And of course, anybody would be, but there is also a point that the small town police force, and it was not only a little out of hand, but it was that the police were scared to death too.
Yeah.
So that we handled it badly, in other words.
Yeah.
But when Sewell began to handle it, his children came in to see him. Two of his children were students here.
Oh, really?
And they were all together on the side of the students. And
yeah.
He made a great mistake. And he
yeah.
was practically in tears, really. So what he did, and with my support, was to bring in his close friend, Bert Fisher, who's still around. Bert Fisher, retired now. And was really the support of Sewell during that period that followed. In fact, he helped Sewell all the time, and I have to
say, was he in an official capacity?
I think when Sewell became chancellor, he used Fisher as an unofficial advisor. That
uh-huh.
would be the late summer and early fall of 1967, but
uh-huh.
he was still using him when the troubles came. And then, since he obviously needed help, the head of the university committee and I felt that he needed help and asked him who he needed. Well, he wanted Bert Fisher. So it seems to me that Bert Fisher then became official as the assistant to the chancellor.
F-I-S-H-E-R?
I think it's F-I-S-C-H-E-R.
Uh-huh.
Burton Fisher, he's still in town. He was very sick for a long time. We thought he'd die. But I don't think he did. No, it's F-I-S-H. There's no C. He's a professor emeritus,
mm-hmm.
and he's still in town.
Mm-hmm.
And gives only his home phone number, so you could certainly talk to him. He survived a severe illness.
He's in the book?
He's in the book. In the phone book and in the staff book. Yes, you'd do well to talk to me. He was very supportive of Sewell, of course, and really quite opposed to central administration, that is, me and my student people. I used Bob Taylor.
Yes.
Have you talked with him? Yeah.
I'm in touch with him. I'm waiting. He's in having an operation now, but
yeah, he's just out, just back home. Not a bad time to talk to him because he'll be laid up at home for some weeks, and he's perfectly coherent.
Uh huh.
He's been taping on this
with the Laura.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good.
And having some differences with her as to how he wants to prepare ahead of time.
Uh-huh.
And like to give her a statement and then have her ask questions about it. She didn't want a statement. She wants to ask him questions.
Uh-huh.
Not a very good question to ask her, though. I sympathize with him on that.
Yeah.
When I talked with her, I didn't have anything written to present to her, but I thought about it a little bit in advance and therefore had a fairly planned statement, which I do not have here, by the way.
Yeah.
In this case, Fisher then supported Sewell, and there was some conflict between Fisher, who was very positive, and particularly Taylor, who was my press man, but also was on kind of special assignment to handle this particular thing, particularly handling with reference to press. Though we had two people really in central administration. One of them was a law professor who was brought in to assist us, but I guess not later. George Bunn, B-U-N-N, who later became dean of the law school. He was brought in part-time for this, part-time as a professor of law, then he became full-time professor of law.
Mm-hmm.
There was some conflict between him and Taylor, too, on how you handle this. How you handle these things, of course, because obviously we were involved in it, because not only did the general public still think of the president as the person, and, you know, after all, Fleming only did a short time, wasn't too well known around the state,
right.
and and I was the one out making speeches anyway, and Sewell was known at all around the state, so that the regents, the public, tend to think of me, and therefore I had to have somebody there.
Were you getting heat right away over there?
Yeah.
Where from?
Well, regents.
Did they call you?
No, when they came in. No, they didn't call me.
There was a meeting?
Well, monthly meeting. At the time, a monthly meeting.
Yeah.
I can have to telescope this in order to get you to the period that interests you. But the regents were at this time changing from very supportive regents.
Yeah.
And an extremely capable group of regents.
Yeah.
In my early days as president, I had an extraordinarily capable group of regents, Arthur de Bartolin.
How do you spell that?
Arthur.
Yeah.
D-E, capital B-A-R-D-E-L-E-B-E-N.
Uh-huh.
He just left the regents, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacob Friedrich.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I've got the spelling of that one right, because it's a funny spelling. F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-K, I think. F-R-I-E-D-R-I-C-K, though that might not be correct. He's a labor man. An uneducated labor man, you might say.
Without formal education beyond the sixth grade, but one of the best regents I ever had.
Those are two terrific regents. I had some other good ones, too. And I had support from those regions. But the political thing changed. The Democrats lost. They won in 62, the year I became president. They lost in 64. And from then on, regents were all appointed by the governor, who was quite friendly to the university and quite friendly to me, but tended to appoint right-wing Republican regents.
You're talking about Knowles.
Knowles.
Yeah.
Rather a liberal and certainly a friend of the university, and in a way a kind of a defender of me, but the region, some of the regents he appointed were extreme right wing, and this was where I
right
some difficulties. Now, actually, of course, regents change too, and regents are in touch with their friends, and the climate of opinion changed in the state too.
Right. Yeah.
Not only that, but individual regents change, because one regent comes from the old days, Charles Gillette.
Right.
G-E-L-A-T-T.
Right.
Charles Gillette was extraordinarily liberal for a Republican businessman.
Yeah.
And was a great supporter of mine.
Uh-huh.
But shifted over in the course of this.
Uh-huh.
As the regents changed,
mm-hmm.
in that he wanted to be a leader of the regents. Oh, I don't know, you can't give motives on these things. He was, after all, in touch with all of his friends who were shocked by what was happening and whatnot.
Yeah.
He certainly had ambitions, and that he would have liked to become governor, I'm sure. Although I guess that might be something I would just as soon have off the record.
Okay.
I'm not even sure I'll say it when I get to being writing my own stuff. But Charles Gillette is an indication of how things changed. They changed so much that the regents were in favor of crackdown.
Yeah.
They were a little perplexed by the Dow thing and felt, well, all right, we made some mistakes. But they were, after that, kind of down on me. They were becoming down on me anyway because I was understood to be a product of the liberal democratic period.
Did they consider you too soft on the
students? Oh, yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. Had you been critical of the police role in the Dow?
No, I wouldn't say that I was altogether soft. Because I was sympathetic to the position of the police. And when we did reschedule Dow examinations, we scheduled them in the field house, and we had the police there. Only a few people came to be interviewed, of course. I was out there some and talked to the police, and I'm sympathetic to the police. They had their problems too. Of course, it's true that police who tend to be not college educated in the college town tend to be anti-student, especially since they run into students when the students are in bars and the girl students are apt to be snippy to them and whatnot. And the general feeling is that they're not part of it, looked down upon and so on.
Right.
So that I can understand that's not perhaps admirable and understandable still.
Right.
And it's a tiny force, a force of 30, a force of university police was very small. And the city police is very small, as compared with, say, New York, where they said in New York that to handle something like the Columbia thing, you needed four policemen for every sit-in person. You couldn't have four policemen for every protest.
The ratio was reversed, I'm sure.
I was sympathetic, except that
I was known to be to the left. I was willing to join when I had discussions with the regents. I was willing to join them in some criticism of liberals because I said, after all, you know, I have a radical background myself. Not a liberal background. I'm critical of the liberals. I said, tell the regents that. I come from some radical background, but I said, I'm not in favor of violence. Now, so that the regents, well, this kind of a guy. Moreover, that's, after all, I was the professor who turned out the new left diplomats. Who turned out Bill Williams? Was in trouble with the FBI. I turned out a good many of these others. There's quite a batch of these new left historians who were my students. You know, Lloyd Gardner at Rutgers, for example, Walter Lefevre at Cornell,
uh-huh.
as well as Bill Williams and Cormac here.
Uh-huh.
And it was known that I was associated with Harvey Goldberg. To what extent? The regents knew all that, I don't know, but Goldberg was a prominent person. And I was a defender of Goldberg. I was a defender of Goldberg. I brought him here. So that I was looked upon with some doubt. Anyway, naturally I would be. I was the president of the DeBart Lehman and Friedrich kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
I had not been associated with Elbum's position, which Elvin had told the regents privately if a person was was a member of the Communist Party, it shouldn't be on our faculty. See, E.B. Fred, predecessor but one before me, had signed a statement by the Association of American Universities that communists should not be members of faculty.
Really?
He was one of the holdouts, but it was a unanimous statement pushed by the president of Harvard, probably. I don't know. In any case, he was a signer, a little reluctant. Not reluctant because he was doubtful about denouncing communists, but doubtful because he never wanted to say anything. He always wanted to keep from saying anything about anything.
Yeah.
he wanted to keep himself out. Yeah. And he had a very tough right-wing Board of Regents.
Yeah.
Well, we had a problem came up of a former communist on the Milwaukee faculty. And this went to the regents while Elvin was president. I was vice president. And we had a discussion in the education committee in which, would you be in favor of firing this guy if he was still a communist? And both Elvin and Plachy, the chancellor in Milwaukee, said, oh yes, they want to fire him. I didn't say anything. I was cautious, which I probably shouldn't have been. I said, yeah, I think we should keep him, but I didn't say that. But some of the people that I was associated with, and DeBart Lehman was the person I was most associated with because he was head of the regents while I was president, and he was very supportive of me. In fact, he at every point would support me. He'd round up the regents to support me, even when he didn't quite agree.
Yeah.
And he publicly would say, sure, we could have communists on the faculty.
No kidding.
Oh yeah, he was really way out. He objected. In fact, he objected to a great many things. He objected to affirmative action when it first came because he says you can't have to be this favoritism stuff.
Yeah.
Which in a way puts him in an anti-black thing. But his firm position and violently against any religion in the university, for example, any touch of religion, department of religion, anything like that. I didn't want to have a meditation room in the hospital until one of the regents offered money for it. And then he would have it only if it was non-religious.
no crossings and stuff. And he went to court up in his hometown, to prevent the Baptists from having a meeting in the courthouse when their, I don't know, building burned down or was their building was being burned.
Is he still around, the bar?
Yeah, he's up there.
In what town?
In Park Falls. He's one of the ablest lawyers I ever ran into. He's a defense lawyer who won't serve up there, you know. Big accounts would be with the utility companies, and they offered to have him, give him a retainer. He would have a part of it. Take retainers against him.
Interesting.
All right, now, that is of some interest, because he was a known, he'd left the Regents by 67, but he was a known close associate with me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the right-wing Regents told me, well, troubles with me. Says it's too much to Bartley.
Uh-huh.
Because I've retained connections with Bartley.
Yeah, yeah.
Bartley had supported me vigorously.
Yeah.
And I was to some extent associated. However, I don't complain about that. It's a proper relationship anyway. I was certainly against the right wing. Now, there's a tricky thing here. I did take the position that as a university president, I should not take stands on public questions. And I would not then take a personal stand against the Vietnam War, which I now look back on and think was a mistake. I should have made a great point. Well, I'll let separate myself personally from my position as president. I'm against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was, of course, pretty much so.
Yeah.
And I guess it's generally known, although the students didn't really know it. But I was several times involved. For example, when it came to make peace and whatnot.
Yeah. Make peace with whom?
Students, when they hold it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Some of the faculty members who wanted to hold the students down a little bit, and Bill Williams was one of them.
Yeah. I remember he discouraged them on one occasion, yeah. I remember.
He on one occasion called me in to talk to them, saying he knew he did that at some risk to himself. That would, to some extent.
He called you in to talk to his class?
No, to talk to a...
To a group?
A group of 68. Before he left for Oregon.
Uh-huh.
He said, some risk to himself. He knew some risk to me. But I talked with him, and he said they're willing to accept me to some extent. Well, you know, I like that, like the Madison Club thing. I was regarded as a better president than the Board of Regents was regarded as the Board of Regents. But this got out of hand, of course, because even the liberals or the moderate radicals administration were denounced by the people that began to take hold of the student troubles. And after all, Kerr was a liberal.
Sure.
In fact, the attack came to be on those
liberals
people. And the liberal campuses were the ones that were attacked. Harvard, Columbia, Berkeley, Madison.
Well, liberals themselves were in disfavor with the radicals. It became unfashionable to be a liberal.
Well, I thought rather poorly of most liberals too, as far as I'm concerned. So ultimately, I don't know. Some of my friends says, "Well, why didn't the faculty stand up for you more when it looked like you might be going? Why didn't they demand that stand?" So, and I did have one telegram sent to the Regents. one telegram sent to the Regents from a faculty member saying, "Force Harrington to reconsider his resignation." As my friends on the faculty said, well, I resigned. Yeah. If I had not resigned, I would have had some support. How much? I don't know. Probably not all that much, because...
Were you under pressure to resign?
Well, that's another... Let's get to that just a little
that's
later.
That's later on, yeah.
Just a little later. First of all, after the Dow thing, I was in some disfavor with the board, but not all that disfavor, because I was taking the stand, well, we made a mistake, we should make sure that Dow continues to come to campus. We should stand up for people coming to campus and defend them. That is, I took a stand very much against the position of the radicals. After all, they hooted down
Kennedy.
Ted Kennedy.
Yeah. That's right.
And that was unutterable, and when we have a president come here, as you see from the chapter 9, says no presidents ever come here anymore since Truman, but
Mrs. Johnson was going to come here.
Yeah.
And she sent out an advance agent or something. She was coming here. She was, I don't know, getting rid of automobile dumps or defending the landscape or something.
Yeah.
And I talked with her advance agent and said, oh, we'll defend her to the, we'll defend her. That's what we must do. I felt that very strongly.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the reasons. Reasons were satisfied to some extent with on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, she decided not to go, and went to Spring Green instead, where she wouldn't have any trouble.
Yeah.
I thought Frank Wright was kind of a wild one too, but not around anymore, and not
right. Living. Right.
So that they didn't come. But when they wanted to, when they were willing to come, they did, and we had Hubert Humphrey here, and he wasn't shouted down. He was good at handling the crowd. Something he could talk forever. And then we had Jaffitz here, and he was a supporter of the Vietnam War. We had Humphrey here because we wanted him to support us for getting the Midwest Accelerator, which finally went to Illinois.
Uh-huh.
But that was another kind of politics. But we had Jaffitz here. On some student group brought him in, and Jaffitz was supporting the war.
Uh-huh.
And he supported it in the Wisconsin Union with all these people against him.
Yeah.
He's brilliant.
Yeah.
I introduced him.
Yeah.
I introduced him.
And he...
just terrific. He'd get uh-huh. a question. I helped some and said, we just have going to have questions. We're not going to have speeches. So we get speeches anyway, of course, a little bit from the people that would specialize in that. But I'd say questions, mimic the question, then he would restate the question.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out extremely well. There was some sullen feeling and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that I had withdrawn a little from it, and the fact that when we had the university faculty meeting, it was Sewell that was up in front, not me. I attended the meeting. The first meeting we had after the Dow thing.
Yes.
Sewell was the chair. I was in the audience, but I didn't speak.
Uh-huh.
And the second one, we had another one, I did speak to support Sewell, but in a way I was pulling out of it. I didn't want to blame Sewell.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to support him at every point. But to some extent, Sewell needed support with reference to the fact that we're going to have these interviews and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
He was willing to do that, mm-hmm. although he was really very anxious to be friendly with the students. I think he probably cared a lot more about students than most professors. Maybe more than Ed Young, who was mm-hmm. always an administrator,
mm-hmm.
partly because of his bad eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
Or I, who handled big classes and graduate students who didn't get to know him.
Mm-hmm.
He was a warm one. Bill's a warmer person anyway, yeah. than either I or Ed Young.
Is Sewell still around here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's had health troubles too. He's had a neck or back problem.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't go to Hawaii, which he would normally do at this time of year, because after he retired, he went to East West Center every winter. But he stayed here.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him lately, so he's mm-hmm. a very good person to talk to. We tried to get involved with the students when Martin Luther King was killed. He was he wanted to take charge of this, but and let the blacks take charge of this. Made a speech, but he felt for the students.
Mm-hmm.
I think more than I.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any case, that was the situation, but Sewell wasn't thought of very well by the Regents.
Uh-huh.
He was blamed a little more than I was blamed.
Uh-huh.
They didn't want to fire him. On the other hand, Sewell had taken the job on a one-year basis. He had said he didn't know that he wanted to be administrator. He wanted to be for a year and see how he liked it.
Yeah.
Because he was, after all, a very distinguished sociologist, and was on his way to being president of the American Sociology Association.
Yeah.
And at the end of the year, because it was understood with the Regents that he wanted it for a year, the Regents didn't want it to continue.
Uh-huh.
And in a way, I suppose I didn't either. Although if he had
felt he wanted to, I suppose I would have fought for him, although I don't know what the reasons would have done. He had accepted the appointment for a year. But he and I had a talk in which he said, well, I guess he was willing to continue. But I said, well, you know, there's a good question here with the regions quite hostile as to whether you should. And the way you feel about things, I want you if you should. In fact, there's some question as to whether I should continue, how long I should continue. This was 68.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, in any case, I must continue. I must continue. Because he said I was needed and whatnot. But given the fact that he didn't feel he had Regent support,
mm-hmm.
and he certainly didn't, he quit. You talk with him about it.
Yeah.
In fact, he's put on tape on this, I think, and he'd be willing to read the tape on it.
Mm-hmm.
You get permission to read the tape, I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
We then had to select something. So we appointed a committee. We got a lot of names. And here, of course, the regents can decide. And, of course, regents can decide and make appointments without consulting these committees if they want to. And when they appointed my successor, they didn't take anybody who was supported by the faculty. And I took John Weaver, who had been thrown out by the faculty search and screen. But the search and screen came up with a committee. The search and screen came up. Faculty, administration, student, one student representative. They came up with a slate, which had some pretty good people on it. Leon Epstein, for example, who's another person involved in these days that's still around. Leon Epstein.
Yeah.
He was dean for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that name.
Leon Epstein, he was dean.
Mm-hmm.
And it was political science. He's still in political science. Distinguished professor. Was in administration for a while and then left. And Epstein was one of the people suggested. And I don't know who it was, but there were several people. But Ed Young was left off. Ed Young had been for a long time dean of letters and science.
Mm-hmm.
Right into the student difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Then he'd gone to the University of Maine.
Right, right.
And at the University of Maine, he got in some trouble because Maine was made into a system. He was the head of the University of Maine, Orono.
Uh-huh.
And maybe he didn't make head of the system, but he didn't want to be. Well, he thought the campus job was a better one. Yet he didn't want to be head of a campus with somebody who loved him. So he wanted to leave. So I brought him back as a vice president. And had in mind that he would do all state stuff. He'd do help with politics. He had a very good political person, and that he would do Milwaukee stuff and handle the Green Bay and Park Side and so on, and be helpful too in Madison.
Were you grooming him for chancellor?
Well, I didn't know. I didn't know that. I didn't know but what Sewell might succeed.
Yeah.
In fact, I think Sewell was one of the best people we ever had for the job.
Yeah. Just the wrong time.
Wrong time.
Yeah.
Wrong time. One of the people whom I admire. He was the guy that started this social science stuff that ended with me becoming president. But he got tired of it got tired of President Fred not being willing to support him and defeating a possibility of getting a big foreign grant. So. Mm. So I was always a great supporter of his, and he's been of mine, I guess. Well, in any case, Bliss did not have Ed Young on it, although Ed Young had just become a vice president. In a way, I obviously wanted Ed Young also to support in connection with the student troubles, because I knew that Ed Young was a little stronger, tended to be a little stronger than I was in terms of taking a position with reference to being against the students. I didn't want to be all that against the students.
He was willing to be the hard guy.
That was not as clear then. I thought he might be a little harder than I.
Yeah.
And I might very well have him be handling that matter with Bob Taylor, with whom he got along very well.
Ed's a feisty kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As chancellor then, he did take that position. And that was fine.
One of the results of it, though, was that that cast me in the soft position for the Regents. You can understand it.
Yeah.
So the Regents began baiting me then. And this came to a crisis a little while later, after I had become Chancellor, in a Regents meeting.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've heard about this one.
I'm not sure.
Up in Green Bay.
Yeah.
It was Hobbitown, Green Bay. The Regents, there was a meeting towards the end when, and actually Lucy, who was going to be later governor, was there.
Yeah.
It was ready, about to run for governor.
Yeah.
And the Regents were trying to take over, because we're trying,
right.
They said they want me to run the, I'd run everything.
Dillon wasn't he the Green Bay Packers team
Green Bay
position?
Packers position, yes.
Yeah.
An orthopedic surgeon.
And he was a real rabid right-winger, wasn't he?
Yes, quite right-wing.
Yeah.
But the particular case was the case of Regent Pelisek. Pelisek was a Regent, P-E-L-I-S-E-K,
yeah.
A Milwaukee Regent,
yeah.
Who headed a Regent committee. The Regents appointed a committee on bullhorns. You see, they were trying to take over.
Right.
Trying to take over.
Right.
And Pelisek came in with a report to the Regents saying bullhorns should not be used because these radicals were using them. And all the protesters are using them. Bullhorns should not be used, said this committee, except for before football games and for homecoming and things like this.
Right.
And I then said, Regent Pelisek, do you really mean that we should use bullhorns for fun and games, but not for the great social discussion of the great social issues of the day? In a way, I was accepting my position that they were putting me in. It was at that point that he said, Mr. President, the people of the state are getting sick and tired of you.
Pelisek said that?
Pelisek said it.
Mm.
In the region meeting. In public region meeting. With the future governor there.
Wow.
This must have been 1970. Early 1970.
About the time of the Cambodia Kent State riots.
Well, it certainly wasn't before I resigned. I resigned in May.
Uh-huh.
And it may well have been even before I decided to resign, even before the regents, some of the regents suggested I should.
Yeah.
Well, in any case,
did you have anything to say back to him at that point?
Well, it was, I'd said it.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought it was a pretty good statement.
Yeah.
Should you not discuss the great social issues of the day?
Are those minutes of those meetings available?
Regent meetings, public regent meetings. It'll be up.
Yeah.
You should probably look at that. I guess I can't date it exactly. If I could, I could tell you whether it was after I decided to resign or not.
I bet
it must have been very early in 1970, because in 1969-70 I went away for most of the fall 69-70 term. I was given a tired president grant. Danforth Foundation.
Oh yeah.
I gave presidents. All presidents were having trouble those days.
Yeah.
And they gave us a tired president grant if we were kept on salary. They would give us our travel expenses and our wife's expenses if you go away and think things over and so on. Actually, my wife and I did go away, and we went over to India and whatnot. It was at the point that I pretty well decided, well, what the devil. At some point or other, I'm going to pull out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came back, I found that several of the regents were determined that I should be thrown out, specifically Nellen and Pelisek and Gillette and Ziegler. Those four.
Mm-hmm.
had a private meeting during the period when I was away, when Toadies was acting president, in which they pretty well decided I shouldn't go. And then the proper approach was the approach of the Madison Chancellor rather than the approach of what they thought the president was.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I wasn't all that unwilling to leave in any case, although as I look back on it, probably what I should have done is to get fired. But
it seemed to me, since Ed Young was so favored by the Regents, and his crackdown policy was so favored by them, that that he very well would be made president. Because the thought was that, you know, the president was the guy that was running things. I thought he would be. And that would have been all right with me, because while Ed was a crackdown type who used secret agents among the radicals and whatnot, still, I thought he'd be a very respectful president. I wanted him to be president. He, on the other hand, was supporting me when he knew that I was on the run. Came to me and he said he knew he was the white-haired boy. He said this to me.
The fair-haired boy?
Fair-haired boy. Fair-haired boy. He knew I was. He was the fair-haired boy, and anything he could do to support me, he would be glad to do. That was between the time when I decided to resign and the time when I did resign in May. So that we were friends and have continued to be friends. I never felt quite that he was taking a strong position because he wanted to be president, because actually it turned out he didn't really want to be president. He matched campus was what he really wanted.
I see. Did he ever become president?
He became president.
He did become president.
He became president of the system. He was never president of the university.
I see.
I was really the last president of the university. Because after I resigned and they appointed Weaver to succeed me as president of the university, they immediately then merged things and began have a system, and Weaver was then made president of the system. So he was only briefly president of the university and was president of the system. It was a weak appointment after I left, and it was an appointment of Weaver with president of Missouri. System. He was appointed because the region thought they could run it. Regent Gillette was the guy that picked him. Regent Gillette had known him on the governing board's committees. And they wanted Weaver because they thought they could run it, as I guess they couldn't. It was a little unfortunate, though, because I resigned in May, and in November, Lucy was elected governor. Lucy was not only present at that Regent's meeting early in 1970, but he was friendly with me, reasonably friendly with me, indeed had me out to his house, had my wife and me out to his house with the Speaker of the Assembly during the campaign.
Yeah.
So that, no, not during the campaign, before I resigned.
Yeah.
Before I resigned. Before the campaign. So that if I had stayed on, if I had managed to stay on, were still president in November of 1970. Meanwhile, the bombing had occurred, and Lucy had been elected. It would have been very difficult for them to have fired me, and I probably would not have resigned, because the first Lucy appointment to the Board of Regents system was Arthur DeBartley. However, the reason I resigned and was therefore not. I was therefore a resigned president when the troubles came. The reason I resigned was partly because of this, the conflict on the student business, partly because in any case, I was no longer able to get what I wanted. I was no longer able to run the university. By the time these troubles came along, 69, 70, by the time I went off and thought about things.
Yeah. Unable because of the obstruction of the Regents, or because of things being out of hand generally?
A great variety of things. The student question was such that it absorbed almost everything.
Right.
Second, by that time, the federal support, which was a great thing for our building the university, was dying out. Even before the Nixon, big Nixon cuts and whatnot. Began to die out at the end of the 60s. And the state was turning more difficult so far as getting things done was concerned. And although the Democrats came in again with Lucy, Lucy was as difficult as anybody. Cut the university. If I'd been in, he'd have cut the university, although he probably would have protected me. I don't know, maybe I say I should have stayed, because if I'd been president when Lucy was governor, probably I could have handled it. He said to me later that he would not have merged, he would not have brought the merger if I'd been here. Whether that was because of friendship, probably not, because he's been a very friendly person. or because he thought maybe I could have beaten him in the legislature. Probably couldn't have, because I was losing my legislative support. I lost my legislative support because the general feeling of the state. I was very strong in the legislature in the early 60s. It began to decline, and because as the student troubles came, we began to lose our state support, which was just incredible, incredible in the 60s.
State the extent of the support was incredible. You had a lot of support.
From the 20s on.
Yeah.
30s, 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was enormous. It was incredible. On both political parties, a politician wouldn't dare be against the university.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted these new branches of the university and all that.
Well, this was one of the great world universities, right?
Right. And still is, of course. But it was recognized as one of the great universities. And you took pride in it. This was a great thing. But as soon as the student troubles began, support began to ebb, and along with the ebbing of general support because of the student troubles, came a lot of stuff about sex on the campus and drugs on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the regents and some of the people around the state were very much taken by this drug business, and all this came together to all the publicity around the state. One of the regents, for example, was tremendously excited about the sex stuff. This was Walter Rank, who wanted curfew on the girl students at 5 o'clock. Incredible. And people around the state began to say this, right in saying, well, the big thing, one guy came up to my office and said, the big thing is that it's a dress code you've got to have in order to keep these people in line. But it was the student trouble mainly. But along with it was the sex trouble and the drug trouble, and this is the period when you're beginning to move to co-ed dorms. It's the drugs everywhere.
Right.
So that some of the legislators who were never liked the university much but didn't dare oppose it began to talk about drugs, and they forced us to have meetings on drugs and whatnot.
Right.
And should marijuana be legalized and so on? I generally was brought in to help us, the people, medical people, that felt that marijuana should be legalized.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you see, I was in this box, in this general box. So we lost a lot of support, and among the areas that we never had control of, it was the Alumni Association. Now, in some places, the Alumni Association is a part of the university. Here it isn't, it's outside.
Yeah.
It's outside. Different from some places like Ohio State, for example, where it's inside, and at New York University, they've had a big fight now, which the new president, Brademas, who is a great guy and a friend of mine, has taken it over from being out. It's his. Well, that's very important in a state university, because you'd expect the Alumni Association to help you in the legislature when you're in trouble, and help you always in anything. Student trouble came. No help at all. None. And the head of the regents, Arlie Mux, was violently against us.
Arlie Mux.
Yes, you want to remember him. Because he's around at the time of the bombing. A-R-L-I-E. Arlie Mux.
Yeah.
M-U-C-K-S. Entirely an athletic supporter, as most of the big people in the Alumni Association are. It's a rah-rah Alumni Association.
Yeah.
And a right-wing alumni association. It did support us when everybody was supporting us in the early 60s.
Uh-huh.
But didn't support us. And in fact was, I suppose, our major critic. When they had alumni meetings here, I attended alumni meetings. Maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe I should turn those over to the chancellor, but I felt I should, because that was the firing line. 67, 68, 69. Whew, the alumni came in. Then the ones that were officers of the association, they were violently against students. I was taking the position of defending the students, you see, which again tended to put me in that pattern.
I heard that Elroy Hirsch blamed the losing season of the football team on the protest movement.
I don't think so. I don't think so. That losing season. We had brought Elroy in. We had some very bad seasons. We had a terrible bad season Bruin's last season was bad, and finally Bruin resigned, which is what he did. Not fired. Resigned. And with Williamson dying, and an accident, falling down the stairs, I think. Then the question was, who should we get? And there was a lot of feeling among the alumni and the regents that we should get a name like Moxon to revive the spirit. But I was very much in favor of that. And in fact, with the regents, urged that they give him a very high salary. But the regents were reluctant. They were in favor of low salaries. We did give him a very high salary for them, but it was not a high salary.
Gave who a high salary?
Hirsch.
Yeah.
Did I say Mux?
Yeah.
I meant Hirsch.
Yeah.
I meant Hirsch. So we brought Hirsch in, and I, in other words, I was involved in bringing him in. And he seemed friendly. I went to the first football banquet after that losing season. They lost all the games except one tie. And we were friendly at that time. I don't know if he was blaming. Maybe he thought I was one of the victims of it. But in any case, he seemed quite friendly to me at that time, although I was already being cast as the villain. Indeed, the fellow that introduced me at that athletic meeting was a former boxing coach who was very active in the Alumni Association and a real right-winger.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Walsh, still around too.
Yeah.
And he denounced me in introducing me.
Oh my God.
Then I spoke. And I said, what can you say to a group of boys that have, a group of young men that have lost all their games or tied one? And I said, well, I'll say the same thing that Babe Ruth said when they asked him why he got a bigger salary than Herbert Hoover. I said, Babe Ruth said he had a better season than Hoover did. Well, I said, you had a better season than I did. That was very successful, and I was congratulated for that. And the governor was there, and Hirsch were there. Both spoke supportively of me, whereas the representative of the regents, representative of the Alumni Association, and the athletic crowd and so on spoke against me. So I wouldn't say that of Hirsch. Hirsch is a likable guy, and whereas he might, but among his right-wing people saying that that was why they lost the season, maybe. I don't think he said that. Talk to Elwin. He was around when the
yeah.
focus came. He's retired now. Great guy.
Now,
near the end of our time, I guess. Can we wind it up with something that would hit the point of the
well,
real troubles?
We could come up to the spring of 1970. Of course, you were back at that time, right?
Yes.
So you were aware that there was something called a New Year's gang that was began operations on New Year's Eve, 1969, and did a series of bombings on campus, fire bombings, burned the old gym, the red gym, hit the primate lab by mistake. Nobody knew it was a mistake at the time, but
South Hall.
T-16.
Yeah.
So there was.
I guess I don't. The name doesn't come back to me as the New Year's gang.
Well,
but in any case, yes, I knew what was happening.
Anyway, then you had the GE strike, which was Dow all over again. Then you had the TAA strike
mm-hmm.
in March. In April, you had mm-hmm. major demonstrations and
yes.
riots. You had the trashing of State Street. Then, in May, you have, early May, first week of May, you have Cambodia, then Kent
yes.
State, all hell breaks loose.
Yes.
So that had to be just an incredible time, a terrible time to be president of this university.
Yes, although I was already pulling back, and I had discussions with this particular group of regents that at some point I should resign. I said, I'm not going to do anything until May. But that seemed to be the right time for me to resign. So I guess these right-wing regents knew that I was planning to resign. This would be April? No, this would be January or February when that was known to them. Well, it was not known. It did not leak. In fact, maybe I didn't quite say it was positive.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was kind of out of things. And after I resigned in May, of course, I was out completely, and they were looking to Ed all the time,
mm-hmm.
complete. Mm-hmm. And the bombing, when bombing occurred, when head of the region Ziegler came in, he went to see Head, not to see me. Mm-hmm. Well, I was involved in that and was, again, as I insisted on a high salary for Hirsch, I also insisted on a large reward. The FBI said it would like a large reward. The region didn't want to give a large reward. I said, well, you better come up with it. You better give the whole thing. So that I was, I pushed it. I did that for the regions. They had to put up the money, personally, I guess.
Yeah. They never had to pay it all, but...
Not all, but some of them.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, by this time, Ed was chancellor, and I should say one thing about that. In 68, when Sewell said he wanted to resign, wanted to go back to his department, we accepted his resignation. We had this committee. We didn't have Ed's name on it. And we really didn't have a person that would be a very good candidate. I thought Ken Epstein might be a possibility. It seemed like it had Bry Curl on it as a name. Bry Curl was not acceptable to the regents in any sense. He wouldn't have been, nor to me. He would be one of the persons I would never put on anything. I won't discuss that anymore. But the list was not a list that that seemed awfully promising. And Epstein said, well, no, he didn't want it. It was the guy that should have it, right? And on the list, what do you do? So what I did was went back to the committee. And I said, I've talked to several of these possibilities on the list. And they say Ed's the guy that ought to have this job. And why isn't he on the list? Or should he not be put on the list? Well, it did develop then that there was one person on the committee that didn't want Ed. He was a professor of music who felt that Ed hadn't been favorable to music. Then Ed's predecessor, Albion Ingram, was tone deaf and wasn't very supportive of music either. But in any case, Ed was off the list for, although most people would have thought he was all right. So they agreed to put him on the list. But Dean Wendt, who was also on the who was on that committee and was supporting, was working with me on this to get Ed put back. Thought Ed would be fine, because Ed was a tough guy, tougher than I. Wendt said, well, we're having a little trouble in the committee, because they say, well, here's President Harrington dictating to us, and later on the student regent reported to the student cardinal on all of this, and it was in the student cardinal how this had happened. Harrington came in and said we wanted Young. And so Wendt suggested we put another name on. And so he said the new suggestion was the two names were Ed Young and Professor Byrd in chemistry, chemical engineering. He's a very great man. Byrd has got all kinds of honors, and he can, he's a chemical engineer who can lecture in Japanese in Japan and in Dutch in the Netherlands. Well, great man. But oddly enough, an advisor to Dow Chemical. Although it was not known by the known to end Wendt, known to me, but not known to the students. It would have really been something like that.
Yeah.
In any case, Wendt knew that it would be Ed that would get it, and so Ed was appointed, and that was enthusiastic. So actually, with Ed being appointed, 68, it looked like with Ed Regents, my feeling, well, this is mainly a matter for the Madison campus to run, and Milwaukee campus was having a little trouble. And the Milwaukee campus to handle with support from the regents and from the central administration. So it looked like I might survive in this connection, except that as things got more difficult and feelings against me became greater than this desire to get rid of me mounted to such that probably in December 69 they decided they wanted to get rid of me. Probably in January or February 70, maybe about the time of this conflict in the regents. It was clear that regents weren't going to look to me, the public wasn't going to look to me, and I would be denounced pretty generally by almost anybody. The press, some of the press was for crackdown.
Yeah.
But not supportive of me, supportive of Young. Some of the press were rather sympathetic to the students.
Mm-hmm.
Like Capital Times.
Right.
Matt Palmer got an award for being for reporting the stuff.
Yeah.
And again, not very supportive of me.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, I suppose you say I was caught between.
Right.
As I found, a great many of my friends out in India were. when I was out in India for 6 years, they were caught the same way. Mm-hmm. And it's not a matter of my defending myself. I thought I handled it badly. But that's about the size of it. So that after May of 1970, I wasn't awfully involved. I was called to Washington with a half dozen other university presidents to talk to Nixon.
Yeah.
At the time of the Cambodian troubles.
Yeah.
And was one of those that told the president, you know, all kinds of trouble on campus, and it isn't just trouble from the left-wing students, it's right-wing students too. We had a group of students, right-wing students, who wanted to go see Mel Laird, the secretary who was from Wisconsin, and Nixon saw the point there and indicated, well, he had closed down Agnew a little bit, but of course he was lying all the time, and said one of us could come in and sit with him and have lead access to him. So Alex Heard of Vanderbilt was the guy that did that, and of course he got the runaround too.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In fact, Kissinger was at the meeting with Nixon, who met with us, and they were already bombing Cambodia and lying about it. That was nothing much, but it happened. We went to the White House, and right after that came the May meeting of the Regents, which I came back and resigned.
Uh-huh.
So at least one of the periodicals, Newsweek then, a Senate personnel for this, having troubles, said that I went to this meeting with the president, came back, and when I came into town, there was a smell of tear gas, and I then resigned. Well, of course, I decided to do it several months in advance.
Yeah.
And the Newsweek man was kind of a dope. In any case, he got most things wrong.
Yeah.
A black man, so I shouldn't say anything against him, I suppose.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a very good person. We did have some good good people here on some of the things, but...
Yeah.
So that from then on, I really didn't figure very much, except for this one time on the FBI, on the reward.
Speaking of the FBI, there had been a point where the FBI had been... You'd had to call in the FBI to do some work on campus, I think. Going back to maybe the black strike, remember the black student strike?
I guess Ed was in touch with the FBI. I guess I wasn't. I wasn't not favored by the FBI anyway.
Yeah.
There was a lot of derogatory information about me. And there was one fellow in town, Captain Bolenbeck, who was a professional patriot.
Oh, yeah?
Professor Bolenbeck told me, no, Professor Bolenbeck, Captain Bolenbeck.
Captain Bolenbeck?
Captain Bolenbeck. He was he was one of those way out patriots, you know. And Cap Times always used him as a whipping boy. Kind of pathetic because he wasn't very effective. Captain Bolenbeck told me that every week he wrote a letter to the FBI denouncing me. See, for one thing, I signed at least one petition for releasing the people during the war, releasing the people who had been put in jail under the Smith Act.
Is that right?
Hmm. And,
what, Japanese, you mean? Japanese-American?
No. Smith Act was radicals.
Okay.
Radicals.
Right.
Socialist workers and stuff.
Right.
That was held against me. Paul Link was a left-wing campus person, and I were among the signers. So I got some publicity on that, too, way back when I was a professor. Surprising I got to be president, maybe, I don't know. But in any case, all that stuff was brought back. And Captain Bolenbeck, having put all the stuff in the FBI files, the FBI never liked me much. They always were a little doubtful about me, and Bolenbeck kept it up into this period, and there was at least one member of the legislature made especially this, Senator Roselip.
Oh, yes.
Who was the great whipping boy of the Cardinals, as Bolenbeck was of the... But he was a clown, and didn't have any strength downtown anyway, but Captain... Bolenbeck denounced me to the FBI, and meanwhile, the Senator Roselip attacked me where he could make a speech. He'd make a speech in favor of motherhood and wave the flag and so on, and he'd say, "What better flag is there to wrap yourself in than this one? And what better person is there to support than your mother? And what better thing is to support than butter?" Because he was against the margarine, you know. Failed the margarine test. He couldn't tell the difference between margarine and butter. One of these fellows like Opie tricked him into it. He would denounce me, and that's what Dyke did too. Mm-hmm. The Dyke supported, as mayor, he was mayor then. Dyke supported Ed Young publicly,
yes,
and denounced,
yes,
me publicly.
Yes, no kidding.
Okay, and so did Senator Roseland. But it wasn't all that bad to handle. One time I was at a, at a hearing, and Roselip opened up. He says, "What about this signing this petition against the Smith Act?" I said, and I made a speech, because I won this one. I made a speech in which I said, "Senator Roselip, are you accusing me of being a security risk? Are you accusing me of being a communist or something?" And said, "Did you know I had security clearance from the State Department? I had security clearance from the Defense Department. That I had security clearance from the even from the FBI." And I can use classified documents and so on. Insane thing. But this was put on tape, and the state station played this all around the state, which probably
didn't. Was that true that you had all those clearances?
Oh, yeah, sure. You have to have, you see, the president had to sign things.
Oh.
But it's also true that I was against classified documents,
uh-huh,
and I would not let the, and when I became president, I stopped the permission of security agencies looking at our files, like the psychiatric files. They had been permitted to look at them by our dean of students and so on, Roy Luperg, and by previous presidents. They'd been permitted to see these things, and I stopped it right then. See, well, that didn't please them. I had some visitations on this. So, see, in some respects, I suppose I had a reputation around of being a bad person all the way through, but not a public, not too much of a public one.
I better put call Laura Smale, just to let her know that it's on my way.
Yeah.
I think for the president, but I don't do that. I have to write a book, but when I get through with my indie book.
Well, that should be an interesting book.
Yeah, just a chapter, one chapter on the student stuff. Although probably deserve to be more of an interest in that, but I think one chapter, because
yeah,
I have other chapters to write,
yeah. Yeah.
On the social science humanities on Milwaukee.
What was the attraction to being president of this place?
Oh, tremendous in 1962, not 1970.
Yeah.
In 1962, it was the best job in the country. Because it's a great university, and yet it had a problem of bringing the social sciences and humanities back.
Yeah.
And it looked like we were on the way because we had a favorable Board of Regents.
And you did bring it back.
Did bring it back, yeah.
Because
it was very successful, extremely successful.
By the late 60s, your history department was,
yeah,
top-ranked,
mm-hmm,
sociology top-ranked.
Political science.
Political science.
Economics.
Economics.
Yep, right.
So
we did bring it back. It was successful.
Mm-hmm.
And we broke the war monopoly. And we built University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. That is, we satisfied the urban need for a university. That was very much in my mind.
Yeah.
And we developed extension. We got into all these New Frontier programs.
Yeah.
Established the Institute for Research in Poverty. We got going on affirmative action a little bit. We've retreated since, so that it was a great place. In fact, there's no reason for being a president unless you can promote something and move something. I've always been a promoter rather than an administrator, and
so
that was the reason why one wanted to be president. As to would one want to be president now, it wouldn't seem as attractive, although I suppose if you're coming up, you might want to be.
So you really did feel, I mean, you had reason to feel that you had accomplished,
oh, yes,
perhaps most of what you set out to,
oh, yes,
by the end of the decade.
Yes, well, I thought we should have accomplished more.
Ironically, in strengthening the humanities, I mean, the university had become a magnet to bright students from all over the country.
Yes.
They were coming in,
yes,
in droves, especially,
yes,
from back east.
Right.
Okay.
We've always been to some extent.
And ironically, this became the brought on the accusation,
right,
that you had brought in all these outside agitators, all these,
right,
East Coast kids were causing all this trouble.
Yes, except that that's a theme that goes way back to the 1920s, and that is, the Ivy League wouldn't let Jews in. We allowed Jews in, 20s and the 30s, so we got very good Jewish students, some of them right-wing, and a good, some of them left-wing, so that we had this reputation, and a proper reputation of getting bright East Coast students who weren't admitted to the Ivy League. The Ivy League simply wouldn't let them in. And the registrar at Swarthmore told me that they only let a very few very bright Jews student in, and the word around Swarthmore came that just bright Jews, all the brightest students around campus were Jews, so he said they admitted some stupid Jews to make it look like Jews weren't any brighter than the rest of the students.
This happened at Swarthmore?
You can believe it.
That's interesting.
Well, actually, there are books now on the Jews at Yale and Harvard, exclusion, and that's what built the university. That's one of the things that built the university as a liberal university, as a left-wing university,
as a
cosmopolitan university,
mm-hmm.
as well as our success on the extension, the boundaries of the campus, the boundaries of the state, which comes from agriculture extension and general extension, and that's before the big influx of those people. But it's quite true that the building up of social science and humanities, or the recapture of them, because they were very strong before World War I with Commons and Ely and Turner and Ross, all those people, they were strong, but they slipped, you see, in the 30s and 40s. Whereas the sciences grew because they had the war money,
mm-hmm.
and they were the first ones into federal money. So that we recaptured the social sciences and humanities, and it is true that that has effects one way or the other. It isn't just a matter of these as a magnet for all these peculiar people, but it's also a fact matter of size. And I must say, we didn't handle the size question very well. We probably should have done something to keep the universe growing quite as fast as it did, make it a little unmanageable. What?
It did. How did it grow a lot while you were president?
Oh yes. That was a big period of growth.
It was around 35,000 when I got here in 66, I think.
Well, that was the period of growth.
Uh-huh.
It had doubled.
I see.
In the 60s.
I see. Yeah.
And, double, that's something. Because it hasn't changed much since.
Yeah.
The growth has been in the specialty.
Yeah. Okay, well, very good. I probably should get going.
You should.
You know, there are...
So should I.
there are...